Our culture has become consumed with the idea of relativity, that there's no such thing as absolute truth. Everybody can decide his or her own reality. Now, on the surface, that might sound like a reasonable philosophy, but today, on Truth for Life, Alistair Begg explains why relativity doesn't work. He's teaching from Philippians chapter 4, verses 1 through 9.
The Christian's preoccupation is to be with that which is virtuous, which calls down the approval of God, and which deserves the praise of men. Now notice also that the call that he issues is a call to think. Those of you who are school teachers know just what a challenge that is. You're not at the point of getting them to think about certain things, you're just at the point of getting them to actually think. Now, folks, let's try and use our minds this morning. Let's do something radically different. And the same is true, again, I suggest to you, in a Christian church that has grown very fond of cliches and very fond of talking about how it feels about everything. And the call here is a call, and the word that he uses is a very important word, logizomai, which means to bring your faculties to bear upon these things. We're going to see, not today, but we will see, that the Bible calls us in verse 8 not only to think, but again in verse 9 also to do. The Bible never introduces us to mental reflection for its own sake. It is always thinking, doing. Romans 12, 2, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds. The renewed mind reveals itself in transformed activity. So what he's saying is groove it in. Bring all of your mental faculties to bear upon these things. I want you to think about these things in such a way that you groove into the thought processes of your life the very channels which will be approved of by God and which will be praiseworthy by men and by women. And this thinking activity is not a moment's thought in passing, but it is continual, it is habitual, because the human mind will always attach itself to something, and it is therefore imperative that we focus our minds on the right things. Now, if we were in a dialogue, we could stop for a moment and talk about the place of secular literature and the place of contemporary music and art and so on. We're not dialoguing, and so we can't. But I should let you know that I do not subscribe to the notion that we need to remove from the minds of our children all books which are not, quote, Christian books. In the fear that when they read Daniel Defoe, when they read Swift, or when they read Lewis Carroll, or when they read whoever it is they read, that somehow or another they will be violating Philippians 4:8 because it mentions in there something that isn't true or something that isn't honorable, etc. On that basis, you can never read any book at all. You can never even read the newspaper. This is a classic illustration of which we need to be in the world but not of the world. In other words, as our minds pass through that information, we do not bring our faculties to bear upon its error, taking it to ourselves, imbibing it, and grooving it in. As says somebody, but there is the risk there that you might. Yes, there is. And that is why it is imperative that from infancy, Deuteronomy 6, we train up our children, we talk about these things as we walk along the road and when we lie down and when we get up, we bind them on the tablets of our hearts, and we make sure that it is grooved into their thinking so that when they encounter some evolutionary perspective, the antenna goes up and they come home and they say, Mom, what a strange thing. Mrs. So-and-so told me I came from a monkey. And the mother says, well, sometimes you act like a little monkey, but you didn't come from a monkey. Although your dad sometimes acts like an ape, but you didn't come from a monkey. Now, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Now, the first thing on the list is truth. Finally, brothers, whatever is true. Think about that. Now, that immediately poses a problem, doesn't it? In an earlier generation, at another point in history, at least in America, the notion of whatever is true could have been stated, acknowledged, and we might move on. But at this point in a postmodern culture, the fact of the matter is, if we say whatever is true, we hear the voice of Pilate from the first century saying, "Ah, yeah, but what is truth?" And the cumulative cacophony of sound down through the ages has reached epidemic proportions now in our universities and colleges. You may recall me mentioning being with my family in a Johnny Rockets in Santa Barbara, and the waitress being from UCSB, and she telling us that she was a philosophy major at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and I just said to her in passing as she was giving us the ketchup, I said, "And what do you think about true truth?" And her rejoinder was, "I don't think about true truth, because I don't believe there is such a thing." And as I dialogue with her, she could think of only one person in the context of her philosophical studies, and she was now in her third year, who had given any indication that they believed in such a thing. So that when somebody said, "Whatever is true, think about that," they would go, "Gotcha, will do." Everyone said, "Depends what you mean by true." You see, relativism, which is what we're dealing with, claims that what we think is knowledge, what we think is a firm grasp of truth and reality, is really only an opinion. You can say it's true for you, but it sure isn't true for me. Now, unless I'm living in a bubble, my experience is that this is one of the great conversation finishers, the things that people say to us that end up being a terminus for us when we don't know where to go next. We've done our best. We shared a little bit about our experience. We mentioned something from the Gospels. And then all of a sudden their rejoinder is, "Well, that may be true for you, but it's not true for me." What do you do then? Because you see, relativism claims that objective universal truth just does not exist. You say, "Well, please don't get off on this, Alistair. This is a sideline." No. It's tangential to our study, but I want to stay with it for a moment or two. The extent to which this is the case is borne out in every research study at the moment in this country. In 1991, the Barna Research Group found that 66% of American adults didn't believe that absolute truth exists. Specifically, these individuals, when interviewed, agreed that, quotes, "There is no such thing as absolute truth." And two people, they said, could define truth in totally conflicting ways and still both be correct. When relativism is the standard by which everything is gauged, then there is no objective standard by which things may be ratified. Do you see how difficult it is to be an attorney in these days? How in the wide world do you get a verdict in a court of law with a jury of 12 people, 3 out of 4 who believe in relativism? And a judge sitting behind the bench who himself has concluded there is no such thing as truth. Most disturbing of all is the fact that the researchers discovered that 53% of those who declared themselves to be born-again Christians also maintained a relativistic view. Now, to the degree that we are simply representative of evangelicalism, that means that part of my task, our task as pastors, is to help a congregation that is increasingly buying the notion of relativism to the degree that more than 50% of the people there, at least 1 in 2 of the group to whom you are speaking, when you mention truth, are replying from the perspective of a relativist. They're saying not, "I have to believe this Bible." They're saying, "I don't have to do that." They're saying, "I don't have to apply this in relationship to my marriage. That doesn't mean what it says about morality. That's not what it means about premarital sex. That's not why you have to exercise discipline." "No, no, no, why not?" "Because it might be true to you, but it isn't truth for me." So it's not like out there with a big bogeyman. It is, if the statistics are accurate at all, right in here. So before you are ever able to go out and declare true truth to a relativistic culture, you have to first declare true truth to a relativistic church. When he conducted the poll 3 years later in 1994, Barna discovered that the statistic was getting worse, not better, and that 72% of American adults declared their conviction regarding relativism. He said, well, it doesn't really matter. I mean, it doesn't affect the way you live your life. You bet your life. It affects everything you do in your life. You are what you think. And our friends are what they think. And the law of non-contradiction is shot. That's why a person can say one thing and do another thing and stand up and say the two things are not mutually exclusive. Gene Veith, in his book Postmodern Times, gives a pathetic indication of the implications of relativism laying hold of the heart of a generation as he quotes the words of a young lady. She says, "I belong to the blank generation." What a phrase. "I belong to the blank generation. I have no beliefs. I belong to no community, tradition, or anything like that. I'm lost in this vast, vast world. I belong nowhere. I have absolutely no identity." You can't tell me that relativism is something to be debated in the ivory towers of the university of the Western world and that it has no impact on the grassroots. Listen, as you drive away from here today, you are driving in a context in which virtually 3 out of 4 people who are driving alongside you have got no real reason as to why they shouldn't take a baseball bat and smash it right through your windscreen. Accept pragmatism, accept the last vestiges of normalcy, accept that's not what nice people do, but not because it was wrong, because there's no wrong. That's where we live. I can't remember the group and I can't remember the song, but I have 2 lines in my mind. And every road that leads me there is winding. And every light that guides my way is blinding. You know that song? And every road that leads me there is winding. And every light that guides my way is blinding. But I understand that. And you know what? I'm glad of their honesty. I can talk to those kids. It's the smarty pants businessman who's not prepared to face up to it. Every road you take winds. There's no direct point between A and B for you. And every light towards which you move blinds you in its iridescent glow. It's vain, it's empty, it's futility. That's why you feel how you feel. That's why nothing tastes. That's why there is nothing in the extra zero at the end of the paycheck. It leads nowhere. Well, you say, okay, you made the point, very good. Don't you think you should stop now? Yeah, probably I should stop. But what do you say to these people? That's the question. Well, you know, you have to say, let's get another coffee because this is probably going to be quite a long discussion. I don't think it's a good idea to say, when they say, well, you know, that may be true for you, but it's not true for me. I don't think it's a good idea to say, you know, you're a real dumb, self-contradicting nincompoop, you know that? I don't think that has the sort of endearing qualities to it that you might want to use. But I think it'd be good to say when somebody says, well, that may be true for you, but it's not true for me, to say, you know, I'm hearing you, but there's something that just seems self-contradictory about that statement. Person says, well, what do you mean self-contradictory about the statement? Say, well, I don't think the statement works. You see, when the relativist says everyone's beliefs are true or false only relative to himself, the relativist means everybody except him. See, you say, well, I believe in the Bible. They say, well, that's just true for you. I mean, that's just relative to you and to yourself. But his statement that it's just relative is an absolute statement. If he's going to be true about relativism, he has to say nothing is objectively true, including my own relativistic position. So you're free to accept my position or you're free to reject my position. But the relativist is unwilling to relativize his relativism. And that's what we have to get them to do. We have to say your relativism is relative. You can't take the high ground. You can't say that mine is a truth claim, which is relative, and yours is a true truth, which, of course, exists in your own little island. Geisler is very helpful in this. He says, if truth can only be relative, then it must only be relatively true for the relativist. But when you think about it, that can't be claimed in any absolute sense either. So you can't say the relativist, well, that's only relatively true for you. Because, says Geisler, it can only be relatively true, then it is relatively true that it is relatively true. And where do you want to stop? There's no place to stop. It just goes to, it's futility. I belong to the blank generation. See? She thought it through. Either the claim, and I'm quoting Geisler again, either the claim that truth is relative is an absolute claim, which would falsify the relativist position, or it is an assertion that can never be made. Because every time you make it, you have to add another relatively. It's the beginning of an infinite regress that will never pay off in a real statement. The Christian conviction, the biblical worldview, says that truth is discovered not as a result of human speculation, but that truth is discovered as a result of revelation. So that when the Bible begins, "In the beginning, God," it is making a statement, a true statement, about the nature of the universe. And that when a man or a woman chooses to think logically from what is and traces it back, it is not an illogical progression to arrive at an unmoved mover, to arrive at that which has itself no, to arrive at a creator God. But even then, with all of the best of our searching, it doesn't bring us there. It is only as God has disclosed himself. And therefore, the Christian conviction is that God has made himself known in the world in which he is made. He has made himself known in the word that he has given to us. That takes us into the realm of textual criticism. Takes us into the matter of the historicity of the Bible. It makes us fight and think all those things through. Because if we're going to make the assertion, Psalm 33:4, that the word of the Lord is right and true, we're going to have to know something about the evidence for the New Testament documents. If we're going to declare the psalmist's words with conviction in Psalm 119 and 151, "Yet you are near, O Lord, and all your commands are true." 160, "All your words are true. All your righteous laws are eternal." Then we are challenging the blank generation that surrounds us. Now, here's the thing that we're going to see, I hope. That is that just in the same way as we cannot think of knowing the peace of God in abstraction from these virtues, we cannot ultimately understand truth except as it then is extrapolated for us. Because I think that nobility, rightness, purity, loveliness, admirability, excellence, and praiseworthiness are all ultimately characteristics of truth. That when you take up truth like a prism or a diamond, and you hold it at one, you see nobility, you see admirability, you see rightness, and so on. And as you examine it in that way, so the Christian does have a view on contemporary art. There is a reason as to why it would be possible for us to argue that the work of Salvador Dali is in many cases ugly. Because it is an expression of a worldview that is not ordered by truth. And here is the means, incidentally, young people, as we'll see, of how to choose your albums, sacred and secular. Here is the way to determine what pieces of art you want to have in your home. Here is the plumb line against which we can discover how to build a library. Because a Christian way of thinking is not just thinking Christian thoughts, singing Christian songs, reading Christian books, going to Christian schools. It is learning to think about the whole spectrum of life, scientific and sexual, material and maternal, from the perspective of a mind that has been trained in truth. And until we get it, there isn't a hope in the world of our secular neighbors and friends coming close to getting it.
The Power of Proper Thinking. That's the title of our message today from Alistair Begg. You're listening to Truth for Life. Alistair will return in just a minute to close with prayer. But before he does, I want to tell you about a compelling book that we're highlighting this month. You have probably heard the name Eric Little. Alistair mentions him from time to time. He was also the subject of an Oscar-winning movie called Chariots of Fire. But though you may be familiar with Eric Little's athletic accomplishments, there is so much more to his story. If you're looking for an enjoyable and spiritually enriching book to read this summer, this is an excellent choice. We'll send you a copy to express our thanks when you support this ministry with a donation. There are a couple of ways you can do that. You can give online at truthforlife.org/donate, or you can call 888-588-7884. If you'd prefer to write us, you can also mail your donation with your request for the book. Write to Truth for Life at P.O. Box 39-8000, Cleveland, Ohio, 44139. Your donation isn't just a gift to Truth for Life. In a very real sense, this is a gift to your fellow listeners, because it's through listeners like you that God provides the financial support that makes this ministry possible. Every time someone stumbles on this program while listening to the radio or downloads a message from the Truth for Life mobile app, their thanks for this ministry belongs to you, and we are so grateful. In case you missed it, here's the contact information one more time. Visit truthforlife.org/donate or call 888-588-7884. Now to close with prayer, here's Alistair.
Father, out of an abundance of all these words that send our minds in multiple directions, we pray that you will help us at least to determine on the strength of what we've thought about this morning to get serious about reading our Bibles, about reading books on apologetics, about searching out the thought forms of our day. We recognize that it's very easy for us to climb into our little citadels, sing our songs to one another, proof text each other, and yet be pretty hopeless when it comes to standing in the lab on a late Monday afternoon, or standing over technical drawings, or examining samples of DNA, or thinking about English literature or drama. Help us to see, O God, that you are vaster than all these things, that you are great and greatly to be praised. We want you to send us out in the power of your Spirit, so that those who as yet have never heard might come to hear the saving news that there is in the Lord Jesus. Help us today in our conversations not to be content with simply passing people off with a couple of cliches and a how do you do. Give us a strong reminder as to why it is you've given us 2 ears and only one tongue. For Jesus' sake we ask it. Amen.
I'm Bob Lapine. Our culture often portrays personal indulgence as the path to the good life. But tomorrow, Alistair challenges that view. Be sure to join us. This daily program features the Bible teaching of Alistair Begg, and it's furnished by Truth for Life, where the learning is for living.